making less and less sense in Silver Lake, Echo Park, Eagle Rock, because all those houses, you can no longer get those, you know, at a really low price. Now you're paying a premium for them and you're going to have to put money into them. So it just doesn't make sense. You can't get as big of a return. So this area, if you're looking to get a return on your money, this is the area to go to.
The invasion of the house flippers. There goes the neighborhood. Our series on housing and gentrification looks at the people and the money changing neighborhoods. That's coming up. First, though, KCRW's Kim Masters, host of The Business Here and editor at large of The Hollywood Reporter, has been a go-to source for many news outlets on the Harvey Weinstein story, including our own. But she wrote another sexual harassment story earlier this year that didn't get much attention. This one was about Roy Price, the former head of Amazon Studios. When he got wind of Kim's story, Price went on the offensive and threatened to sue any outlet that printed the piece. None would, not even her own publication, The Hollywood Reporter. Finally, in August, the story did come out on a website called The Information, which covers the tech industry, and it barely made a ripple in the news world. But then came Harvey Weinstein. Kim Masters is with me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, for people who don't know the story yet, what did Roy Price do and to whom?
What started this all off was we learned of a 2015 incident at Comic-Con in which Issa Hackett, who is the daughter of Philip K. Dick, and that she is the controller of author Philip K. Dick's literary works. And Man in the High Castle is one of Amazon's most successful shows and is based on Issa Hackett's father's work. Mm-hmm. So she was there at Comic-Con, and she was doing a long day of publicity and promotion for the show, which was relatively new at that point. And at the end of an evening, she got into a cab with Roy Price and another Amazon executive, and Roy Price began to proposition her in very lewd terms. She was very taken aback by this, and he had invited her. This cab ride was going to an Amazon staff party. So as soon as they arrived, she peeled off in a different direction and was sort of talking to other people in the state of agitation, and suddenly she found Roy Price in her ear whispering, or not really whispering, she was apparently kind of loud, something about another sex act. I don't know, Madeline, do we want to say?
I think we get it, yeah. Something, yeah, lewd.
Something, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there were other incidents, and we're following up, and we had a lot of this stuff that I could not get published anywhere. Even The Information sort of stripped it down to a very basic thing that Roy Price had made unwanted sexual comments. They didn't say what they were, even though I had put that in my original story. One of the problems I had is that my sources did not want to go on the record because mm-hmm. they all have entanglements of some kind with Amazon. Mm. But I did have five people who were willing to come forward if he did sue and reveal themselves and testify in court about what had happened. So this was a hurdle that I couldn't get over, but ultimately in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein incident, or a series of allegations that are terrible against Harvey Weinstein, Issa Hackett, you know, she saw a lot of women coming forward, and she is a very gutsy person. I don't want to suggest that she is anything but that, but she felt finally comfortable to tell the whole story on the record, and that is when Amazon, which had conducted two investigations internally into the conduct of Roy Price and the head of the original series, Joe Lewis, they finally suspended him within a short, you know, two, three hours after we reported the Issa Hackett story.
Because that then was published in The Hollywood Reporter. When she went on the record.
Yes, as soon as she was on the record, we were good to go.
Right. Yeah. So was the problem on the part of not only The Hollywood Reporter, but you talk about The Daily Beast and other national publications, including The New York Times, was the problem that the sources were not on the record, or was the problem the threat of litigation?
I think that both were problems, but there was a kind of fear in the aftermath of the Hulk Hogan case, and Charles Harder was the attorney on that, and they sued over Gawker's publication of his sex tape. And the other thing is that Lisa Bloom, Roy Price's, one of his lawyers, I don't know who made up the lie, but repeated a lie to all the outlets that considered publishing this seriously, that I had tried to get money out of Roy Price. Guess what, Madeline? To underwrite my show on KCRW. And, I know that I've never had a conversation with anyone at KCRW about somebody underwriting my show.
No,
I don't even.
There's a strict firewall.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not a thing, right? It's not. It was that's fabricated out of whole cloth. I almost thought it was funny at first because it was so ridiculous, you know, that it was such a bizarre allegation. But anyway, you know, it made the lawyers at these different publications very nervous. It's like, what if they can smear us in court? What if in this environment, in this country right now where Trump is knocking the press every day, you have an incredibly hostile judge and jury. And what if all five of the sources who said they were coming forward would lie under oath? I mean, it was, you know, you always work with lawyers on stories like this, and sometimes some of them are very helpful, and they help you figure out how to say things without potentially getting into legal hot water. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I felt like the lawyers were just in a state of absolute panic and just wanted to prevent the story from going forward because of they just didn't want to face a lawsuit.
Yeah, you write in the Columbia Journalism Review that this was one of the most difficult chapters in your decades-long career in journalism.
It was very difficult because, you know, I've had many, many legal threats from a lot of places, including multiple threats from the Church of Scientology over the years. And I've just never had an editor just say, well, we can't run this.
And do you think that that's what happened with the Harvey Weinstein story over the years?
I can only speak to my experience. You know, there are all kinds of scuttlebutt about this publication or that had the facts and didn't publish. But for me, I never had it to a place where it was remotely publishable. I'd had nobody on the record among these celebrities who came forward ultimately, Ashley Judd and Gwyneth Paltrow and Rosanna Arquette and, you know, Rose McGowan. We had none of that on the record. And in terms of the women who were not, we knew there were women who had settled who were not well-known women, but we never had even a name to pursue. So it was like banging your head against the wall. We at The Hollywood Reporter would have done it and were close to doing it when the source that we thought was going to go on the record withdrew. So, you know, these people had settlements, they had non-disclosure agreements. It's a real problem when people settle and sign these things, and you can't blame them for settling because the alternative is to face this horrific onslaught from a wealthy person like Harvey Weinstein or you know, the deep pockets, and they'll have you investigated. You know, Harvey was alleged to have planted things in the tabloids to smear people. Taking them on publicly is a big, big deal. So you can't blame them, but we never got to a place where we could get it into shape to print. I don't know if the other publications did or didn't.
Okay, so what's next? Roy Price is suspended, and you're getting calls from all sorts of news outlets. You're very busy.
Yeah.
What's next in this story, do you think?
You know, look, we're in a moment where a lot of women are coming forward. Our next issue of The Hollywood Reporter will have various stories by women who have been through things and, you know, unburdening themselves in some cases after years. You know, one woman sent in a story. She's a seasoned television writer, Janice Hirsch, and she just said, I have this relief in finally telling this story. Is it not a good story of a guy harassing her on the Gary Shandling show? So on the one side, we hope that we're at a turning point, although I don't know, this may just be a moment or not. And I'm getting calls about all sorts of people who have allegedly done all sorts of things. And I have to tell you, sorting through what we want to pursue, what we think is credible, it's daunting. This is obviously a big, huge problem in this industry and other industries. And we're at this moment now where I'm getting calls all the time saying, look at this person, look at that person. This person has 9 settlements, you know, somebody who's absolutely huge and whose name you'd recognize instantly. We don't want to make it into a thing where we're chasing people around who, you know, for no reason, but at the same time, we don't want to ignore valid news.
Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter. She also hosts KCRW's The Business. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
Coming up, the hashtag MeToo has lit up social media with women telling their stories of sexual harassment and assault. And now a group of women in Sacramento is calling out a pervasive culture of harassment, as they call it. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The hashtag MeToo has become a phenomenon online since actress Alyssa Milano coined it Sunday afternoon, asking people to write MeToo if they had been sexually harassed or assaulted. MeToo was tweeted more than 500,000 times. Millions of women have weighed in on Facebook. Countless are sharing their personal stories. Among them, women who work at the California State Capitol in Sacramento, including lawmakers, lobbyists, and staffers. Around 150 signed a public letter calling out what they say is a pervasive culture of sexual harassment in politics. Samantha Corbin is among those who signed the letter. She's a partner at the Sacramento-based lobbying firm Corbin and Kaiser. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you. Well, if you feel comfortable sharing, what was your experience?
I'm definitely not comfortable sharing my experiences, mm-hmm. and I've had a few. I would say they range from, sort of microaggressions to outright, physical interactions. Uh-huh. But I think what's more important than sort of what's perceived as kind of the sexy storyline of individual instances is the fact that as we started elevating the level of discourse, every single one of our colleagues, either themselves or a friend of theirs, had been impacted by some kind of sexual harassment in this community. And, not just at lower levels. We're not just talking about 25-year-old scheduler or junior lobbyist, but all the way up to and including seated members of the legislature, none of the women in our community have been insulated from this type of behavior.
Yeah. One lawmaker says that she, after she was elected and went to Sacramento, she was actually groped by a lobbyist. And this is someone who had just become a lawmaker.
Right, right.
In a position of power.
When we made the call, to action to our community, we were just overwhelmed by the number of emails, phone calls, text messages, and stories that started pouring in from folks over the last really just 3 days. I mean, hundreds of women. It's overwhelming. It's heartbreaking, actually.
How did this start, your decision to write this open letter?
I have a good friend who I've known for years, who's also a lobbyist at another location, and we were having a conversation amongst sort of our small friend group, as we often do on this subject, both kind of on the heels of the Weinstein news, but also because of a recent instance of actually one of them experiencing sexual harassment. And this particular friend said, we really should do something. And the idea of an op-ed came up, and she had asked, would you sign on to it? If we wrote something that tried to get at the heart of how pervasive this is for us, would you sign on? And I said, absolutely. And what was really a small group of our friends started just rapidly growing as we circulated the draft amongst other colleagues. And I think we hit maybe 400 or 500 different women who looked at, reviewed, provided feedback on the letter just over the last 3 days. And I'll tell you, of the 150 women who did actually sign on, there were at least 150 who didn't and wanted to, but either were told by employers they could not or did not feel like they could avoid retribution or job loss if they signed on.
Hmm. What about naming names? Did that come up? Did you debate whether or not you should actually name specific men who had harassed or assaulted you?
It's definitely was an initial point of discussion. And what we quickly realized, particularly as we started talking to more and more women, is that there's not, even if you came up with a list of the sort of top five worst offenders, there's way more than five. And two, it doesn't get at the heart of the problem, because it's not one individual who needs to be sort of publicly shamed and punished. It's a widespread systemic issue for which we have no tools. We're not talking about it, and because we're not talking about it, we're not doing anything to fix it. And so I think what's most important for those of us who have, luckily are in jobs and have the latitude in our careers where we can elevate this discourse, is that we start looking for solutions to fix it, so that the women who are not as fortunate to be in positions where they can speak so openly do not have to suffer through it anymore.
Okay, so what are some of the solutions that you're talking about?
Well, number one is have the conversation. What we realized, even just amongst our friend group, you know, you indicate for other people, gosh, look out for that one, or I had this bad experience. If you have a friend that's in a workplace situation that's unsavory, you know, we kind of go undercover and rescue them and pull them out, help them find another job, keep them away from someone that's, you know, maybe not behaving appropriately. And we are constantly on sort of these like very small siloed rescue missions in our friend groups. And yet this is happening all the way across the community, women looking out for their friends, their peers, each other. And every time you rescue one woman and you don't address the issue, you leave a void for another woman to come in and really be treated in exactly the same way. And so having the conversation, illuminating it, is hugely important. And then two, learning how to begin to address it. You know, even we've heard stories from women who have really supportive employers, but when they've tried to report sexual harassment from another perpetrator to an employer, they really don't have the skill set to have the conversation, to try to remedy it. There's not a lot of transparency or accountability in these circumstances, particularly because when you think about the Capitol, we're really a micro community of a lot of different employers. You have the third house, which is represented by lobbying firms as well as in-house lobbyists. You have the staff in the Capitol. You have, you know, law enforcement working in and around the Capitol, and then any number of other individuals, fundraisers, et cetera, who sort of operate in this universe and partake in this culture.
Well, the thing that I noticed about these two solutions that you've mentioned is that they put the onus on women first to have the conversation amongst themselves, as you mentioned, and then to learn how to address it, learn how to bring these complaints to HR managers or what have you. What about the men?
Well, I want to be clear. I think it has to go far beyond the women because, frankly, the burden has been on us for far too long. But we do have to play a role in having the conversation, and the men, as difficult as it is to have these conversations, need to meet us at the table and start actively talking about solutions. And that has to look like better oversight, better accountability, better training, and better resources. And we're clearly, you know, the system is working exactly how it's designed to, and right now it is not designed to protect women in the workplace.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from men in the Capitol?
It's a great question, and shockingly one I wasn't prepared to answer, but there was a lot of fear I heard from folks as it was circulating. You know, not a lot of men saw the letter and were very worried. I think there's a lot of concern about, to your point, of sort of, quote, naming names, which certainly is not part of, at least any of those of us that are organizing this effort is part of, not part of our goal. And then there's been men who have really approached very quietly and said, I want to be supportive. I don't know what to say. What do I say? How do I talk about it? But then we've also seen, you know, leaders in the legislature come out and say, let's talk about this. How are we actually going to address this on a go forward? And those men, thankfully, are in a position to be very helpful as we're trying to figure out how to solve this, you know, more systemically.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Samantha Corbin. She's a partner at the Sacramento-based lobbying firm Corbin & Kaiser, among those who has written an open letter about being sexually harassed. Coming up, when the house flippers come to town,
people in like Mercedes and Porsches, like, oh, would you like to sell? And my dad's like, well, I didn't have a for sale sign. Why would you assume I want to sell?
Our series, There Goes the Neighborhood, is next on Press Play. Press Play, I'm Madeline Brand with more of our series, There Goes the Neighborhood.
I'm just confused as to, like, who are these people? Like, how, and then houses get snapped up in a day. It's like, what am I doing wrong? Where is this cash coming from? Like, it boggles my mind.
As a homeowner, my equity is skyrocketing. My home has doubled in value in 5 years. But that also is insane.
Today we had I guess, 18 people or so here just for this one bedroom here clamoring to sign a lease.
People will go out, and once they get a hang of it, they'll start buying property, and then they just get into buying property, and then they just, it's almost like a drug.
Every single day, I get some real estate advertisement or a request to sell in my mailbox.
And they're going to lose the home one way or the other. It's much better if a local investor can buy the property and convert it into a home that another family can use.
All the time we hear, you know what, gee, I've held onto this property for 30 years and now it's time to sell it and I don't know what to do. And so that's where we come in.
If you had to name a villain in the story of our current housing market, there's a good chance it would be the house flipper. Not that there's anything wrong with quartz countertops or those sideways fences. Flippers are not a new phenomenon, of course, but they are helping to drive the big changes taking place in many LA neighborhoods. Here's KCRW's Saul Gonzalez.
Sometimes when change comes to a neighborhood, it's quiet and subtle. Other times, it's loud and blunt, like a pickaxe punching through drywall. Peter Schulberg is starting demolition work today on a house he's just bought in Los Angeles' Jefferson Park neighborhood. Largely Latino and African American, Jefferson Park is just south of the Santa Monica 10 freeway between downtown and LA's west side.
It's opening up the house to, you know, what it would have been.
Like other homes on the street, the house is a small, century-old craftsman cottage. And it's been worn down by neglect and some really bad renovation work done over the decades, like a popcorn ceiling added in the 1970s and a dining area that's been turned into an illegal third bedroom. So Peter is gutting it and restoring the home to its original condition and charm.
Every house, no matter how small, has a little soul to it. And what I find when I come into these places is it's about trying to give them back the kind of hope they had when they were built.
But Peter isn't purely motivated by architectural altruism. He's one of those people who buy broken-down houses, fixes them up, and resells them at a higher price.
I am a flipper. I kind of cringe a little bit whenever I admit that, but yes, that's what I've been doing for the last 4 years.
Why the cringe? Well, Peter says flippers like him are at least partly responsible for jacking up Los Angeles' already high home prices.
And what's your timeline, roughly?
I'm hoping, I always say 3 months, it's always 5 months.
He knows if he adds value to a home by flipping it, that will increase the price of other homes in the neighborhood. And that will make it harder for working people to buy or rent in the area. And prices here are already high, even for old homes in Jefferson Park that need a ton of remodeling.
This house was $578, which is much more than I've ever spent on any house. I mean, that's what's happening is a year ago this would have been $478, 3 years ago this would have been $350. I mean, it's just gone crazy.
Eva Aubrey's seen the craziness. She's lived in the neighborhood since the 1950s and says now the flippers are always circling.
Every single day, somebody wants me to sell my house. Somebody wants to know if I want to get a loan on my house. They want to give me everything, but they want my house.
I'm Saul Gonzalez, and you're listening to There Goes the Neighborhood LA. Flipping used to mostly be associated with the suburbs, especially during the Great Recession. That's when more than 9 million people nationwide lost their homes. But now the supply of foreclosed houses in the burbs that flippers used to scoop up cheap has dried up. So flippers are moving into cities.
1,345,000 to the bid now, 50. 1,350,000.
About 70 property hunters are in this darkened hotel conference room south of downtown LA. It's a property auction, and many in the room are flippers bidding on bank-owned houses in and around Los Angeles.
100% of the funds that you want to bid and buy with, you must have on your person.
Chris Demarest is with Auction.com, the company that runs the auction.
There is no time allotment to go to the bank to get more. You can't run to your partner on the other side of the hotel. You can't even go to your car to get more money. So you can only bid with what you have within the room. And that's a strict rule.
Jonathan Rios is a full-time flipper, always on the hunt for new properties and loving the chase.
We almost think of it as treasure hunters. And it's like the homestead, boom, you know, they shoot it off. And once they find out what an opening bid is, everyone runs to the property, tries to see what the appraised value is, what the rehab is going to be, what kind of title they have on the property. And, you know, everyone has a team, and it's basically every team on a treasure hunt is what it's like.
Jonathan works for Wedgewood Incorporated. It's a Redondo Beach company that claims to flip about 3,000 properties a year. And Jonathan has specific orders from his bosses. Find houses that can earn the biggest profits on resale and don't overbid.
I want to buy every property for a dollar. It's ideal.
That's the ideal.
That's ideal. That's, basically, I want everyone to just hand me properties and titles for deeds and then just walk away and high-five me and say, have a good day. If it makes dollars, it makes sense.
And final call, $1,387,500 the bid. And that's going to be sold at $1,385,000. Subject to receipt of funds at $1,000.
Honestly, this area is a great place to look. And also, it's one of the last places in L.A. proper where you can find an affordable flip that makes sense.
I'm back in L.A.'s Jefferson Park neighborhood talking to Dave Fink. He's with an L.A. real estate company that's trying to flip an 830-square-foot stucco house on a corner lot.
The price on this is $680.
$680?
Yeah.
$680.
$680, yes. So for that price, I would say it's a pretty fair steal.
Dave's company bought it for $460,000.
It's making less and less sense in Silver Lake, Echo Park, Eagle Rock, because all those houses, you can no longer get those, you know, at a really low price. Now you're paying a premium for them, and you're going to have to put money into them, so it just doesn't make sense. You can't get as big of a return. So this area, if you're looking to get a return on your money, this is the area to go to. And we're seeing it. I mean, houses are going fast here.
According to Adam Data Solutions, the hottest zip codes for flipping in Los Angeles are all in South LA. That's right. In some South LA zip codes last year, 20% of houses sold were flips, three times the Los Angeles average. And who's buying the flip properties?
When did you move in?
Summer of last year.
Oh, okay. So you've
been Many of them are 20 yeah, yeah. or 30-somethings looking for their first house, but who can't afford the prices in other parts of L.A.
I was living in Los Feliz, working in West Hollywood, you know, so coming down here to South L.A., it was a big change. And
that's James Blackman, 29 years old and originally from New York. He works as an actor, filmmaker, and bartender. James is a self-described hipster, and he has the look down, from tattooed arms to his knit beanie.
Yeah, homework stuff, man. Like they say, there's always something to do, always a project. They were so right about that, as you can see.
Last year, after renting in L.A. for 6 years, James bought a flipped house near Central Avenue in South Los Angeles for $360,000.
So the importance of this place is I'm becoming an adult in my own way, not the traditional way. Like, I know the traditional way has always been like, oh, yeah, get a house, get a car, you know, white picket fence, all that. I kind of did it through the back door because I don't have a traditional job, but I still was able to get the house. And I feel pretty damn good about that.
James's house is pretty no frills on the outside. But inside,
they did, you know, put all the bells and whistles that made people think like, oh man, this house is amazing. Gas range stove. They did some trendy things like high-end engineered laminate. People go crazy over that, you know, the
and that kind of gray shade that's really popular right now.
Yeah, yeah, with all the laser etching that makes it look like real wood. It's like things like that, like, impress potential buyers.
And along with adding design bling, flippers know they also have to talk up neighborhoods, boasting to potential buyers that if they're not cool now, they soon will be. A few miles west from James's place, Dave Fink describes the community surrounding the property he's trying to sell.
If you're from L.A., I describe it as it's like Echo Park and Glassell Park and Eagle Rock 5 to 10 years ago, right before it started to really get gentrified and really booming. But you're seeing all over the place in this neighborhood people buying up commercial spaces. They're putting in coffee shops, gastro pubs. I mean, you know, this area is really developing into a really pleasant place to live.
As flippers invest in once neglected LA neighborhoods, there are many who love it.
I don't feel guilty. It's good. It's improving the neighborhood, and I enjoy it.
Homeowners Marsha Hosea and Jennifer Thistle in nearby Leimert Park say bring on the flippers if they help attract businesses and boost neighborhood value.
I like to have an uplift in the community where I don't have to always go and shop and give my dollars outside of the community because they don't offer the things that I like in the 1 or 2 mile radius.
So you're saying bring on the nice stores,
yes.
Bring on the coffee houses,
oh, yes.
The boutique stores, I
yes.
mean, at least some of that.
Yes, definitely. And raise property values.
And raise property values.
Oh, yes. Well,
we're looking forward to that.
We want that, yes.
Oh, you want what?
Oh, the property values, you know, real estate, definitely. Location, 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 right?
Others, like Eva Aubrey, who you met earlier, worry about flippers pricing people out of their communities.
This was a working class neighborhood. When my family first moved here, people who lived in this area were mailmen, nurses, policemen. These were people who went to work every day and who had jobs, who didn't make a lot of money, but they made enough money to live comfortably.
But Ava thinks flipping will change that.
It's pushing these people out. The younger people, I don't know how they can afford it. The young ones behind me, where are they going to go? What could they buy? How can they live? What's happening is they're pushing people out. These people who live in this house or that house,
They
can't afford to live there anymore.
Oscar Moreno is a high school teacher from South LA who lives with his father in a home they own. He worries about keeping accumulated wealth in the community.
People in like Mercedes and Porsches, like, oh, would you like to sell? And my dad's like, well, I didn't have a for sale sign. Why would you assume I want to sell? And then they throw at us that we'll give you, let's say, 15-20% above market value to take your house. And so anyone that's struggling, right, will take that offer. Long-term wise, that offer that they're giving you is actually a low-ball offer because they know even though they give you that 15%, in the next 10 years, that property value is just going to continue to go up.
You know, when you're renovating, dust, it gets on everything and you're always cleaning.
James Blackman knows that by buying a home that's been flipped, he's playing a role in driving neighborhood housing prices up, and that could be a source of tension with his neighbors. Now, James is Black. He says that might soften some grumbling about how he's a gentrifier in this largely African-American and Latino neighborhood, but only so much. So, he has this advice for other outsiders moving here or other gentrifying LA neighborhoods.
You should tread lightly because, you know, people can be funny when it comes to change. It's a weird thing, like when people come face to face with real deal change in their lives, you know, like things are not going to be the same anymore. Some people accept it and are open to it, but some people are just not, and they fight against it with every breath that they take.
In Jefferson Park, Peter Schulberg thinks he can have the home he bought for $578,000 and is rehabbing back on the market in 3 to 4 months. His likely asking price?
Well, I'd say
$850,000,
yeah.
$850,000. That, in a neighborhood where homes selling for even half that price 5 years ago, would have seemed like real estate science fiction. Coming up, what's the connection between flipping in Beverly Hills and flipping in South LA? Well, it's money, of course, but where does it all come from? Where do flippers get the money to buy the houses? KCRW's Anna Scott has looked into that and found a little-known phenomenon in flipper financing.
So in the auction Saul went to, people were plopping down $1 million or more in cash. Who has that kind of money lying around? Well, more and more, flippers are getting their money from loans, a specific kind of loan. Not loans from banks, but from real estate investors. They could be rich individuals or large groups of investors pooling their money. To find out more about this business and how it works, I talked to Corey Conkey. 9 in the morning inside a Starbucks. At one of the tables, a tall 28-year-old guy in a button-down shirt and slacks types on a laptop.
I tried to work in a cubicle for a while, and I couldn't do it.
Corey was born and raised in Orange County, about 50 miles south of L.A. In 2008, it was ground zero for the mortgage crisis. From its fallout, Corey started his career, working for a company that loaned money to buyers at foreclosure auctions.
Literally my first day on the job, they handed me a backpack with like $600,000 or $700,000 in it, and they told me to drive to Riverside and buy a property for an investor.
At the time, an injury had just ended Corey's first career as a minor league baseball pitcher. The auction felt a little bit like a game to him.
We didn't win, but I mean, I had an adrenaline rush there. I was shaking, like I had no idea what was going on. It was just the first time I got the same feeling of like playing sports in like a job.
Corey doesn't carry backpacks full of cash anymore, but he still works as a go-between for people with money and people who need money to buy real estate. He matches up borrowers with what are called private lenders or hard money lenders. These are the investors you heard about a minute ago. It is nice work if you can get it.
When you're lending money, all you have to do is just wake up, go to the mailbox, pick up your checks. So there's no, my toilet broke, you know, the third floor of your apartment building's flooded. If that happened to your borrower, you're like, well, you know, it's, I don't care, you know, it's not my problem.
There's not much data on how big the private lending market actually is, but multiple experts told me it's growing fast, including Corey.
It's almost overcrowded right now. It's getting to the point. I think there's always going to be enough property in LA just because there's so many. It's just sheer volume. But there's a lot more people in now because, you know, everyone's been making money. It's the longest bull market we've had in a really long time or ever.
Just like flipping, private lending is connected to the recession. After 2008, it became a lot harder to get a bank loan. That created an opportunity for private lenders to step in and provide money to people who wouldn't meet bank standards anymore. Another thing that happened after the crisis was a lot of new regulation on mortgage lending to protect regular people like you and me looking to buy a house. But those rules don't apply to investors buying properties to flip or turn into income generators. So that's who private lenders give money to, because they can charge super high interest rates and demand to be paid back fast. Corey has a meeting with one of those private lenders this morning. But first, he has to stop at the supermarket to pick up booze. Corey says it's a little something to foster goodwill with the lender and his staff. Maybe get his calls returned a little faster.
Girls like Chardonnay, I would say. And then the boss guy likes brown liquor.
And do you switch it up? Is it always alcohol or do you bring
mostly
them different
alcohol.
Things?
Mostly alcohol. We have a really stressful job, and so like, people drink after the end of the day. It's just what people do, so.
It's never like candy?
No, no one does candy. Not in L.A.
Corey, how are you, bud?
Buy some wine.
Oh, how's everything going?
Everything is going great. We're about to have a good month.
Dennis Rediger is in his 40s. Gray hair, slim, dressed in jeans, laid-back vibe. His nickname at his country club is Gatsby. Dennis has about 250 loans out right now, worth around $100 million. That makes him a medium-sized player in this world. He made his money as a landlord. His family owns apartment and office buildings. Dennis wanted to invest that fortune in something low risk with a nice return.
About 7 years ago, we started getting into the loan business because we didn't have anything to do with our money.
That's what a lot of people have done. Interest rates are low, so investing in stocks and bonds isn't as lucrative as investing in a real estate loan where you can charge 10 or 15% interest. Though Corey says competition has pushed those rates down a bit since he started in the business.
When I first started, a few companies were charging 14% and 5 points, and now we're down to like 9 and 2, 9 and 1.5. I mean, that's over, you know, 5 years, 6 years, because of the sheer number of volume and people are getting in, because it is a very safe industry. It's this, you know, probably one of the second oldest professions in the world.
Corey leaves Dennis's office in Burbank.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
And drives to Beverly Hills to a two-story Spanish-style mansion that's under construction. This is one of the properties Corey set up a loan on. The actress who played either the Good Witch or the Bad Witch in The Wizard of Oz once lived here. Corey's not sure which witch. Six investors, actually three married couples, bought this house together for $6 million. They plan to flip it for $15 million. To get that much...
We need to have a pool, you need to have a spa, you need to have a view. Mm. Or if you don't have a view, you need to have land. No, you need to have a gym, a screening room. You have to have some kind of like... theme or like Hollywood kind of feel to the house. You're gonna have like the LA actress kind of, you know, movie star theme. It's gonna have all that other stuff too.
More than doubling the value of this house could raise the value of all the houses around it, too.
How expensive can this neighborhood get?
There's a house in Bel Air right now that's for sale for $250 million.
A house in Bel Air for $250
million? And then I think that's the most expensive house around.
So I guess it could go up quite a bit.
You should take a look at it. It's pretty stupid.
So, Anna, what does selling a giant house in a rich area like Beverly Hills have to do with flipping a house in, like, South L.A.?
Well, first of all, these lenders aren't just giving money to people in Beverly Hills. These house flips that they're funding are also in places like South L.A. But besides that, let's say you have $2 million to spend. You want to buy a house in Beverly Hills. Well, you come to this street and you see that that's out of reach for you. So maybe you go look in Culver City or Silver Lake. That makes those neighborhoods more expensive and on down the line.
You know, these super aggressive lending practices, I can't help but think about what happened before the financial crisis in 2008. Is there a connection there? Is one like the other, and should we be worried?
It's hard to say. It's true that there are similarities. And, Saul, you're not the only person who feels uneasy hearing about this industry. Dave Min, a law professor at UC Irvine who specializes in banking regulation and real estate, said the same thing about being reminded of pre-2008.
One of the myths of the crisis was that these were all poor borrowers trying to buy a home. And in fact, people who've studied what happened with housing prior to the crisis know that, in fact, a lot of these loans that were made pre-crisis were loans made to investors of exactly the type you're describing in this new phenomenon. These were house flippers.
But these lenders aren't connected to the economy in the same way that banks are. And they're not lending money to the average house hunter looking for a home to live in. So it's just really hard to analyze the pitfalls here. It's hard to say what would happen even if a bunch of them failed all at once.
It is worrisome. It's not quite at the level where it might be something that we should be overly concerned about. But it's not something we should ignore given past history.
For now, though, people in the industry are super bullish about it, like the lender who provided the money for that Beverly Hills house.
Hi, I'm Sean Miller, the CEO of Five Arch Companies.
Five Arch is really big in this world. They've got about 1,000 loans out at any time in 20 states. In L.A., Sean sees endless opportunity because he says cities are more desirable than ever. Leading up to 2008, developers built thousands of homes out in the suburbs.
30 to 70 miles away from downtown Los Angeles. That seems to be changing in front of our eyes. The younger generations have this real sense of community and wanting to be much more close to where they work.
He's talking about young people like James Blackman, the actor you heard from earlier, who bought the flipped house in South L.A. People like James want to settle in big cities, but a lot of the housing stock is old. It needs to be fixed up, just like bridges or roads. And Sean says that's what his company does.
You take Brooklyn in New York as a perfect example, where you may have brownstones that literally were at the turn of the century, last century. So instead of really financing a home builder building a tract of 1,000 new homes 60 miles from downtown Phoenix or LA or Dallas, we get to spend a lot of our time looking block by block at homes that are in the areas that the next generation want to be. And you can really marry a little bit of the old with the new. And that product is not going away tomorrow.
Do you see private lending as being at all connected to gentrification? Does it facilitate people coming in and fixing things up and prices going up?
Look, I'll tell you what we do think. I mean, it's certainly better for neighborhoods that haven't had a lot of capital improvements to have more capital go in the neighborhood. I mean, that's like a given.
Sean says companies like his are little drivers of neighborhood change. They're like barnacles on the big drivers. He gave me a couple of examples of big drivers. The new Rams football stadium being built in Inglewood, the acres of development around USC.
Those are movements that come into an area which can shift like the demographics of miles and miles around them by the sheer scale of them. And then really more grassroots efforts from people like ourselves, which really I think are assisting in allowing for these neighborhoods to slowly start to pivot and give more investors and more people confidence that every day goes by, there's going to be more improvement and sort of a higher quality of products. And certainly that would be a neat thing to happen.
When we talk about gentrification in LA, so much attention gets focused on the huge projects like Sean just mentioned, or like the Hollywood Crossroads housing development we talked about in episode one. But a lot of neighborhood change happens one house at a time, with no city hearings or public attention, like properties that get flipped.
And the money behind those tiny changes, it's like an invisible river. You can't see it when you're walking down the street, but you can definitely see its effects. For every house or apartment building that gets fixed up and sold, there could be one, two, or dozens of investors hoping to turn money into more money.
KCRW's Saul Gonzalez with Anna Scott with our series There Goes the Neighborhood. It's available as a podcast, too, on iTunes and at kcrw.com. Next week, we'll ask if artists and writers are to blame for the current housing crisis. All right, Christian Bordahl with some feedback from our listeners.
Yes, these episodes of There Goes the Neighborhood always seem to hit home with people.
So to speak.
W.S. Clark says, listening to There Goes the Neighborhood on Press Play is stressing me out. Where will I go the next time I have to move? Joe Cola says, City Council talks about affordable housing while they take money from developers who come into these neighborhoods and build luxury apartments and giant mini mansions for the rich. Then the locals get swept into the desert while out-of-state tech execs assume our communities. Todd Verma says it's mostly happening on West and East Coast, not the Midwest and South. They remain affordable. But Kerry Schmidt-Spears says, it's happening in Nashville, too. So
it's happening everywhere. All right, Christian Bordahl, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And if you want to express your opinion or weigh in with a story or two, we'd love to hear them. Facebook, Twitter, KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.